Hello and welcome to this podcast by the Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit, featuring a public lecture by governance researcher Anna Larson, entitled Exploring the Future of Democratization in Afghanistan. It was recorded at the ARU Library in Kabul in August 2010, as the country geared up for its second parliamentary election since 2001. ARU has published a series of reports on the election, and on democratization and governance in Afghanistan more generally, all of which are available for download from the ARU website at www.areu.org.af.
Can I say it's a real privilege to be here to talk about some of the research that I've been able to do over the last couple of years with the governance team here at ARU. This is, if you like, a bit of a summary of our project on democracy and democratization in Afghanistan, and specifically Afghan perceptions and perspectives on these two things. So we've been working on it for about 18 months. We actually released a discussion paper, with initial findings from three provinces last year, in September last year. And this looked at perspectives in Balkh and in Kabul and in Parwan provinces, so mainly in secure northern areas with largely Tajik majority population. And of course, a lot of the key feedback from that research was you need to expand this. You need to do more in other areas, in insecure areas, and in areas with more different ethnicities. That's exactly what we did. And we have now synthesized findings from six provinces altogether, having looked at three more in the last 6 months to a year. And the three more are Ghazni and Nangarhar and Nimroz. Just say a little bit about why we selected these provinces. So Nangarhar, we had the border with Pakistan, which was a factor. We had also an urban centre, which was an interesting comparison to Balkh and also to Kabul. We had largely a Pashtun majority, Pashai also, and some others. And also relatively secure in the city. We didn't want to expand into all insecure areas, but we did want a little bit of comparison with those. Ghazni was by far the most insecure area we looked at, and was chosen primarily for that reason, but also because of its rural setting and also not being close to any of the borders as well. And Nimroz because it's so far from the centre of Kabul. We wanted to see whether the central government had any reach at all into Nimroz and what people thought there of perceptions of democracy as well. Okay, so why study perceptions of democracy in Afghanistan? Well, I have to admit it wasn't the intention to do this from the beginning of the programme. We started off looking at Afghanistan's new democratic political parties. I'm a bit of a political parties nut, and I've been interested in parties, so had started off trying to look at these new parties in Afghanistan, what they were doing. These parties sort of formed in the Taliban era and then sort of trying to make their way in the post-Taliban Bonn era. But then we found a lot of problems with these new democratic parties, problems that they were experiencing here in Afghanistan. And the problem seemed to be symptomatic of a larger causal issue with democracy in general and democratization in general. So from the back of that small study then, we decided to expand and look at this issue with democracy and democratization in general. The other reason is that nobody had, at that point anyway, really looked systematically at Afghan perceptions of democracy and democratization. So there had been this sort of tacit assumption in the Bonn process that this was a good thing. It's global best practice to promote democratization in general, especially in post-conflict countries at the moment. So there are those assumptions that have been made, but there was very little systematic study on what Afghans really thought about democracy and democratization. So that was another key reason. Also, final reason was that being in elections time at the moment, it actually is quite interesting to look at the underlying issues of democracy and democratization because, of course, elections are not all there is to it. And we wanted to sort of ground our work on elections in a more sort of overarching theme on representative governance in general. Okay, so before we start going into things, I'd like to just make a few clarifications at the beginning. Democracy. The word, how do we refer to this? How did the study refer to this term? Well, in its most basic definition, obviously there are lots of different definitions, lots of different prefixes put in front of democracy, liberal, social, deliberative, assembly, you name it, many different types of democracy that exist in current usage at the moment. Most basic definition, I'm talking about government by the people, for the people. Right, so a political system in which citizens participate in selecting the government and holding it to account by virtue of their vote. Totally minimalist definition. And then in today's era, we talk about universal suffrage and free elections as the premise on which democracy rests. And I say today's era because universal suffrage is relatively new in the grand scheme of things. I'd like to complicate that, however, by looking at two different theoretical models which shed quite a lot of interesting light on the definitions of democracy here and also the data that we have. Firstly, from Fareed Zakaria, who argues that democracy in itself now is used synonymously with liberal democracy. So the tenets of liberal constitutionalism, such as free trade, rule of law, gender equality, freedom of speech, property rights, these kinds of things which we know to be enshrined within liberal constitutionalism and also quite common in established democracies, come to be encapsulated within the word democracy in general. And that's just one thing to mention. Because it's important because it makes democracy into a badge of honour. Something which is, you know, value-laden, and something which countries get a sort of a big tick mark for if they are democracies or promoting constitutional liberalism. So that's one thing. And it's really important to remember in the Afghan context, because there are some of those values which are inherently secular, and some of those values which are not accepted in all contexts. And I think, as you'll see later on, there are a lot of issues that some of our respondents have with some of the liberal values that are seen to be associated with democracy and democratization. However, I want to look more specifically at something from Charles Tilley, a political scientist who died a couple of years ago, and he was at Columbia University. And he says basically that he focuses on state-citizen relationships as a defining factor in a democracy. He talks about these four characteristics. And the first one is breadth, basically ensuring wide political inclusion of people under the state's jurisdiction. The second one is equality within and among different categories of citizens, and in which ethnicity has no significant connection with the political rights or responsibilities of citizens. The third one is protection, mainly against the state's arbitrary action. And the fourth one is mutually binding consultation. Basically, that there is no bribery or middleman needed in any interaction between the state and the citizens, and that the state has an obligation which is enforceable to its citizens as well. So he defines these four characteristics as fundamental, really, to the extent to which a state is democratic. And I'm going to call this for now substantive democratization or substantive democracy. So he also argues that democracy is not an end point, that there isn't a specific place to which states should aspire necessarily, that democratization is a process, and that democratization occurs on a continuum, so that it can go in one direction towards greater democratization and in another direction towards de-democratization. So if it occurs along this continuum, then it's not unidirectional. And it's equally possible for countries to de-democratize as it is for them to democratize. So his quotation here, democratization means net movement towards broader, more equal, more protected, and more binding consultation between the state and citizens. De-democratization then means net movement towards narrower, more unequal, less protected, and less binding consultation. So what Tilley then does is he draws these models, basically, where he plots state capacity against democracy for a number of countries. And if you look at the book, it's actually quite interesting to see the spaghetti patterns that occur for so many different countries. It's nothing like a linear progression in any situation at all. One thing that doesn't come up in Tilley's analysis, however, is the idea of democratization being imposed from outside. And that's something we'll come on to a little bit later. Okay, so to move on to the main findings from the study. The first one being lack of ownership. I used the word ownership very carefully. It is used a lot these days. It has lost a lot of its meaning. I use it to mean a way in which democracy and democratization are seen to be external processes imposed from outside and not owned by a lot of the Afghans we interviewed. So that interpretations of the word democracy have a lot of imperial connotations, especially in areas which are more insecure. And that, I think, is largely the result of the presence of military troops in those areas. Second finding, the lack of equity and security. These are absolutely fundamental barriers to democratization across the board in six provinces. Thirdly, the support for the idea of democratic institutions is there. Many people talk about the way in which participation in elections is a good thing, that the idea of the parliament is a good thing, that the provincial council is ideally a good institution, but that either it's been taken over by elite capture, or the people within it support their families only and nobody else, or that it doesn't do very much, it doesn't provide services, whatever it might be. So the idea, the support is there for the idea, but just not the manifestation. Okay, so going through these findings then a little bit. The first major interpretation of democracy across the board in six provinces was as unlimited freedom. And this is partly to do with the way in which the word democracy is used synonymously with azadi, meaning freedom. So many people using azadi instead of the word democracy. And this can be taken in two ways. Firstly, the freedom to participate in a positive sense, but also the freedom in a negative sense, which can be misused if it's unlimited or not controlled in some way. So people saying, Tulsi means we have democracy. The TV dramas, the Indian soap operas here mean that we have democracy. Or democracy is the free market, meaning democracy is anarchy. Anybody can charge whatever they want with no control whatsoever from the government. Or pictures of women used to advertise products. This is democracy. People, women, behijabi, going around without what is considered to be the proper covering. This is democracy. And people using it really in a derogative sense to say, I can do whatever I like, it doesn't matter, it's a democracy. So this is an incredibly widespread perception amongst the respondents that we spoke to. The best way that was seen to curb this unlimited freedom by most of the respondents that we talked to, because they referred to the government as perhaps putting laws on social behaviour and things like that, but that the government didn't have very much reach into the community, so maybe that wouldn't be a good way to stop this unlimited freedom from eating into social norms and practices. So the best way, by far, was identified as by imposing or encouraging Islamic values to be more widely practiced across the board. And people talked about the Chahar Chaukat to Islam. And this phrase I use in Dari because it's actually more evocative in Dari than in English. Because it refers to the four fixed edges, basically, the framework, the four fixed edges of Islam into which everything in terms of social behavior and democracy should be fitted. So if everything is within an Islamic framework, if everything is within these limitations, then democracy is a good thing. And if we can have an Islamic democracy, then that's fine. And people talked about these values within the Islamic framework as a value set that we identified with, as opposed to the value set outside of the framework that the foreigners identified with. So this very stark dichotomy drawn. It was very clear to a lot of people that there was Western democracy over here and Islamic democracy within an Islamic framework. And this one was acceptable and this one was not. However, people didn't really define very clearly what values should be in this box and what should be over here. And so there were very mixed perspectives amongst people as to what should be in which section and also to what overlapped. Things like freedom of speech, was that something which could be in both or just in one or the other? It was really quite interesting to see the different perspectives on that and really no clear trend linking that among respondents, except one thing, which was women, basically. It's quite incredible across the transcripts from all six provinces to a varying degree how much women and women's behaviour was linked to Western democracy in particular, and Western practices. We had a number of focus groups here at ARU where we brought our teams back from these different places, and we said, okay, people are talking about Islamic and Western democracy. So if I make this chart here with Western and Islamic on this side here, then you tell me what values should go in each category. And quite incredibly, the first probably 6 or 7 values every time we had these focus groups were to do with women and women's behavior. So it's certainly a dilemma, and in terms of what women's role should be within a democracy in Afghanistan, within an Islamic democracy, we didn't reach any consensus over this between our respondents. Obviously, there are a very broad spectrum between extremely conservative on one side to very liberal on the other. So just to bear in mind that this is inherently linked with people's views about democracy. The third point here, I think, is really important because it was very, very clear in the second phase of the research, especially in the more insecure areas, a more vehement rejection of democracy itself and less of a split between Western and Islamic, but just lumping the two together in a negative sense, as a Western secular imposition. And this generally tended to be much, much stronger in areas where they had a greater military presence. And this, I think, is linked to the idea of being imposed upon, being, having another military presence around to curtail your activities and things like this, and feeling insecure as a result, feeling threatened as a result. And I'd just like to read some of the quotations. I won't read all of them, but some of the quotations which demonstrate the vehemence and the strength of this sentiment. I think democracy is good for the Afghan government, but we don't want government which is in others' hands. We don't want democracy which is applied by foreigners. From Ghazni. In democracy, all the people take part in making decisions about whatever happens in the country. Government should be chosen by people, not by outsiders, but at the moment, the president is chosen by them and we can't say anything. The example of a lady being taken to Kabul needing an operation and being blocked by military vehicles, not being able to get there in time. This is the kind of democracy we see, which is brought to us by the foreign forces. Innocent Muslims are being blown up and their weddings are being bombed. Not once has the international community complained about this or asked why this is happening. They're shouting about democracy and that they want to promote people's freedom, and yet they make no inquiry into the injustices we see here. Just a few of the examples of the strength of feeling coming out, especially from the more insecure areas here. This is not to say that I share this perspective, but I just wanted to present some of the ways in which democracy does seem to be linked with this sense of imposition in insecure areas. So the second big finding basically was the lack of equity and security that people felt. And I said earlier that I would explain why I chose these two particular factors. Basically, many people have said, well, you know, there are so many factors in Afghanistan preventing democracy and democratization or hindering it. What about education? What about economic development? What about the influence from outside forces? Well, actually, across the data, in these 6 provinces, many, many different kinds of people, these two factors were the only shared considerations or the only shared concerns about why things were not getting better in Afghanistan, things were not becoming more democratic. Education is mentioned a lot by educated people. People say, well, we need an educated populace, but that often comes from the elite and not so much from rural communities. Economic development, again, from the elite and also from people who benefit from that economic development, whereas, of course, it's not, at the moment, widespread. So equity, just to talk about that briefly. So many complaints came across in the data about the fact that there is no level playing field here in Afghanistan, that some people, namely those who have money, are above the law and do not have to adhere to the laws of the state. Second, that the systems or institutions themselves are not strong enough to mean the same to all people. It's kind of a link to the first. It's not a level playing field. Personality politics rule, and if you know somebody, if you have wasita and somebody who's a connection in the ministry, then that's fine, but if you don't, you're excluded. Thirdly, the concept of Perak Bansat, which is particularly came up in the Pashtun areas. The idea of a government in which all are represented, and no one group is strong enough to put pressure on another. And people talked about having a wide foundation, the Parag Bansat government being a wide base, which was much stronger than a narrow base on which the institutions of government were wobbling at the moment. And fourthly, the narratives of exclusion. People feeling excluded on a number of different platforms, by their ethnicity, by sometimes gender, region, language, various different narratives of exclusion coming out. But by far the strongest was not so much ethnicity, but rather kaum and family-based exclusion. So if you did have that relative in the government ministry, then that was fine. But if you didn't, then, you know, there was no way that the government was going to extend its service provision to you. So it was more about kaum, or wider family, than about ethnicity as a whole. What about the idea of having no democracy without security? This seemed to come up a lot in transcripts across the board. I give an example here from Kabul, because obviously it's reasonably secure here, and people still saying that to practice and strengthen democracy, there should first of all be security. Of course, this goes against the conventional wisdom that democratization in itself promotes security, because it gives a non-violent means through which people can express their grievances. Of course, it's a vicious cycle. It's both ways. It happens both ways. If you don't have the democratic institutions, then maybe people will use violent methods to express themselves or their grievances. And then again, if you don't have the security, people can't go to the polling stations. They are scared to say what they think, and their livelihoods are threatened. So it really is a question of both being vitally important. However, there is an assumption made, I think, in general, when democratization is pushed in post-conflict settings, that it is being put down on a tabula rasa, or a level playing field, where everybody has exactly the same opportunity in elections, everybody gets voted in to the parliament by merit of their qualifications, and not through some past, I don't know, past fame or past credibility in terms of their military achievements. And I think that's a real assumption that needs to be questioned, especially here, where democratization was pushed fairly quickly, and where you didn't have a tabula rasa at all, and where the bond process did favour some people over others. And you ended up with a situation in which you were allowing some people the vehicle to express their views democratically and not others. And I think that's a real problem and something to consider. Also, just finally here, some aspects of democratization are really considered by a lot of our respondents to actually promote insecurity, like, for example, party competition. In a context where you have a zero-sum politics, winners, losers, and nothing in between, the more somebody wins, the more somebody else loses, then party competition degenerates very often into violent competition. And it has done in the past here in Afghanistan. So you can understand in a way why people are a bit nervous about the idea of promoting opposition between groups and between parties. A lot of people, when they were talking to us about Parliament at the moment, expressed a huge concern that there was this somehow opposition group, or at least kind of standoff, if you like, between the legislative and the executive, and that this wasn't a good thing in which the legislative could monitor the executive or put pressure on it, but rather it was a negative thing because it created instability, and particularly because it was seen to be divided along ethnic lines as well. So this fits quite nicely into Tilley's framework, and I just wanted to bring this back quickly. Talking about breadth and equality really links to what people were saying about missing the equity that they needed to access resources. And then his third and fourth issues, protection and mutually binding consultation, really fit with what people were saying about security from the state's arbitrary actions or from non-state violence, and also in the stability in knowing what the rules of the game are for everybody, no matter who they are. Finally, the third finding. Going back to this idea that people supported the idea of democratic institutions but were disillusioned with the reality or the manifestation here in Afghanistan. Let me just read this quote to you. "There is only so-called democracy in Afghanistan. It is like the lipstick of women, which looks beautiful, but does not have any resistance against licking. It is the same with the structure of the government. It doesn't have the ability to provide governance, so how will it build and serve the country?" Just to a very clear image there of the superficiality or cosmeticness of democracy and democratization attempts here, as seen by a respondent in Nangarhar. Look at the elections, look at the way in which people see them as a positive development in the idea and a positive phenomenon in that they actually have a chance to participate in choosing their leaders. But in the way that the results are changed from the initial results to the official results makes a farce out of things. We had a wonderful quote from, again, somebody in Nangarhar talking about the provincial council elections last year, saying that according to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, there are three things which are uncertain in this world. One of them was the soul, one of them is death, and one of them is judgment day, or doomsday, I think. And he said, now there are four things that are uncertain in the world. The above three things, plus the provincial council elections. and I thought that was great, because, you know, it showed how people had really lost confidence in the outcomes of these elections. Skeptical perceptions of the MPs. As I said before, this real idea that people serve their own families, their calm, but also the self-enrichment that they've seen over the last 5 years. People really skeptical about that and where the money has gone. Widespread disappointment with the activities of these representative bodies. Have they actually done anything? Most people were really quite doubtful about that. But even in spite of these things, people still welcoming the idea of these institutions which would in theory generate access to more people than in previous years to the central government. So why then have these institutions underperformed? Well, there's a few reasons, and there's a lot of reasons in general, including the insecurity, interference of outside actors, but three in particular I'd like to highlight. One, that elections only have been prioritised. They're good in themselves, but it is the contention of this research that they were instigated too quickly, perhaps, without the foundation for democratic institutions underneath. And there's nothing in between. You have a lot of international concern about the elections themselves, about the polls, about getting the statistics and the boxes ticked, and the pictures of women in burqas at the polling stations, but nothing in between. Nothing in the interim period supporting the development of democratic institutions, and no funding for this kind of activity. Second reason, that substantive democratization, what I was talking about before, these four issues have not been an international priority at all. They haven't been an Afghan government priority either, but they are a significant concern for a lot of the Afghans we interviewed. The substantive democracy they talked about was linked to these four points: the equality, the breadth, the protection, and that mutually binding consultation. Thirdly, that there's no incentive to promote democratization strongly among influential national actors either. Maybe this is controversial, but it seems to me that many play the game on the surface, but use the democratic game as an excuse for malpractice, or as a cover for some of the less savoury activities that go on. So let's go back to these three messages again. That democracy and processes of democratization are not universally accepted and understood as this positive phenomena put forward. I think that's very, very clear from the data in terms of people's association with unlimited freedom, people's worry that this is going to upset the way in which society works here in Afghanistan. But perceptions of democracy as an imperial project promoting inequality of resource distribution and linked to insecurity threaten to push Afghanistan towards de-democratization. And I think this is a real significant concern that needs to be taken on board pretty urgently based on the data that we have here. And thirdly, that democratization hasn't been promoted substantively in Afghanistan in general by the international community or government of Afghanistan. And while there are other factors contributing to this, this has also helped to lead towards the widespread disillusionment with democracy and democratic institutions. So, just a few conclusions to throw out for discussion. Many people I've heard in the community here, amongst Afghans and internationals, in the media, have said that Afghanistan is not ready for democracy. I cannot disagree more, and I'd like to suggest a few reasons why. Firstly, because there is clear support amongst Afghans themselves four substantive democratic institutions here in Afghanistan. And this is absolutely clear in this data. There is nothing clearer than that, that people do want to take part in selecting the government. And if that's true, then Afghans themselves are so-called ready for that process. It's also wrong to suggest, I think, that there is a linear progression from readiness to unreadiness, on the other hand. This is a continuum, but it's not linear. It's a fallacy to suggest that there is like a continuum that people move across from being unready to ready in one direction. Also, I think it's dangerous to talk about preconditions for democracy. In other contexts, people have shown that actually, in spite of the most perhaps surprising conditions, or perhaps unsavory conditions that you would expect to promote a democracy, actually democratization has taken place. So I think talking about preconditions is a little bit dangerous. But at the same time, it's also dangerous to institutionalize competition, for example, in elections, that is not competitive, because it increases the power base of those who can shape the rules of the game to their own liking. And I think you see this very strongly in the way in which elections are happening at the moment. So finally then, can substantive democratization be promoted in Afghanistan? Well, I think so. But I think there are some key priorities that need to be addressed if that is to happen. I said by the international community and the government of Afghanistan, either or, it's not one or the other necessarily. They're both key actors in this promotion. So solidifying the rules of the game in elections is a start. Putting more emphasis on the way in which elections can be trusted. And this is not necessarily too difficult a task. Look at last year, look at the way in which results were changed at the central level in Kabul. This was not just a narrative of fraud at the periphery. There was key fraud happening in Kabul, at the central level, in the IEC. And this is much easier to deal with than fraud at the periphery. I'm not saying that at the outskirts in rural areas wasn't a problem, of course it was. But there are things that can be done, there are measures that can be taken to improve people's trust in the elections. Obviously, increasing security would help to promote democratization. Lessening state control, with emphasis on procedures over personalities. And enforcing punitive measures, or actually being committed to rule of law for those refusing to comply with the rules. These are very general, very, very broad, and very obvious suggestions. But I think they're absolutely crucial if the priorities of the respondents we spoke to are to be addressed in some way. Thank you.
Anna now took questions from the audience. The first asked if the research touched on attitudes towards women in the political sphere and whether such attitudes are changing.
Women, it's too difficult to make generalizations across the country in terms of how people perceive women's role to have changed in the last, you're talking about in the last 10 years or so, am I right? It's really too difficult to say. What I can say is that after the first phase, we came out rather positively from this research and said, isn't it amazing? People talk about women's role in terms of democracy, and maybe women might, you know, start not wearing headscarves and this would be a bad thing because they would copy Western democracy. But nobody talked about having a problem with women representing them in Parliament, and nobody talked about having a problem with women working in the public sphere at all. So we thought that was an incredible change, actually, from 2005. I was doing interviews in Mazar in 2005-2006 as well, and people talked with quite a lot of amazement at the time about how so many women had come into Parliament because of the reserved seat system. And that was a shock at the time, and then in 5 years, nobody's talking about it. So maybe that's an implication that it has become normalised to some extent, with caution. However, in the second phase, looking into the more conservative areas, especially in Ghazni, we didn't really see a continuation of that trend. A lot of women talking about, talking very sarcastically about democracy as freedom, Freedom? You see my freedom. I'm stuck in this house all day. They won't let me go to the doctor because they say that I'm damaged goods coming from my family. So how can you call this my freedom? How can you talk about freedom here? So I'm not really sure I can generalize about how democratization has affected women or is seen to have affected women, but there are different narratives coming from different places.
The next question asks if people in the research said what country was the best example of a marriage between Islam and democracy.
People talked about Turkey a lot, but mainly the more secular end of the spectrum, or the more liberal, not more secular, sorry, the more liberal end of the spectrum of respondents that we interviewed. So people saying that Turkey was a good way in which both the principles of so-called Western democracy could be mixed with Islamic democracy. And then people talked negatively more often about lots of other examples, Pakistan mainly being one, but that might be for other reasons. I'd like to also mention something on that line which I completely forgot to talk about in the lecture, which was people's perceptions in Nimroz, which were markedly different from other places that we did interviews in. And it was quite interesting. People talked about democracy quite positively in Nimroz, without the caveats, without the sort of only if it's in an Islamic framework or only if it's not coming to impose on our own cultural norms and values. And I think that was for a number of reasons. One, because of the proximity to Iran and the way in which Mardum Salari has been sort of adopted as the kind of Persian term for democracy there, and people experiencing a sort of Mardum Salari type system and elections under an Islamic government there. So I think that's one factor. Another factor being that there aren't international troops at present stationed in Nimroz, and I think that gives a marked comparison to, say, Ghazni, where people do feel imposed upon very strongly. So you don't get that sense of cultural or military invasion or imposition in Nimroz at the moment. But this is Zaranj and the western side of Nimroz. So we're not talking about the Helmand areas, which I think would probably be much, much different because of insurgent activity and that kind of thing.
The next member of the audience asks if the research team talked to higher level people in the Afghan government or universities, because, in his experience, they can also feel that democracy is an imposed system that's not going to work in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. Yeah, we had a very broad range of respondents. They included Wolesa Joga and provincial council members, university professors, also teachers, lecturers, and in Kabul in particular, members of some of the private universities here, which I know often have quite strong perspectives on this particular issue. So yes, we did, and you're absolutely right. It wasn't a case of everybody who's educated thinks democracy is good. Not at all. There are a lot of perspectives which say, in spite of being very highly educated and very astute, that would say, democracy is not a good system for Afghanistan. So thank you for bringing that up. It's important.
The next speaker talks about experiences in the field in Afghanistan, where he often encounters a feeling that democracy can somehow solve all of the country's problems. Does Anna feel that people understand that democracy is tough, imperfect, and hard to achieve?
I think that's an excellent point, and I think you're absolutely right to bring it up. Very few people actually recognise the failings of democratic societies in other places, because, of course, they're associated with high economic development and a high standard of living and security, and so obviously it's very easy to put them in the pedestal, to put them up on a pedestal where their faults are not recognised. So yes, I do think that is very important. Also, that there is a really widespread sense of, or lack of sense of duty as citizens, I think, amongst, not necessarily amongst the educated elite, but amongst rural communities as well. The expectation that the state will provide, and that I don't have to do anything myself to in return, that there isn't really a process or a duty as citizens. And that's quite interesting, because I think it fits in with what you're saying, that people don't really, especially in the rural areas, people don't really associate a responsibility or the way in which, as you say, democracies in established or established democracies are evolving all the time and involve lobbying and campaigning and active citizenship. So I think that is true. People did talk about the negative aspects of democracies in the West, particularly in terms of their secular values and the way in which, for example, abortion is widespread and divorce is widespread and these kinds of things. So you did get quite a lot of backlash against those sort of negative aspects of Western democracies, but not really an acknowledgement of the way in which lobbying and campaigning actually happen.
The next question is about feelings towards the idea of a central state in general.
I think that probably depends on where the interviews were taking place and the perceptions of the state activities in those areas. In many areas, it's considered to be a predatory agent, really disliked and not wanted at all. So they weren't comfortable with the idea of a state. But in some places like Nimroz, where you'd expect people to be even further removed from the central government, actually there was quite a lot of positivity towards the idea of a state and state intervention, and more disappointment in the way in which they weren't reached by the central government and which they felt excluded from the decisions of Parliament. They didn't have so much electricity, they weren't able to see the debates on TV inside Parliament, they didn't know what the MPs were doing, and they felt significantly disenfranchised from that.
The next speaker says he was surprised by the many middle-class, educated Afghans who did not vote in 2005, and noted that participation has dropped since then. The question is whether respondents were asked if they intended to vote, and was there any relationship between that and their views about democracy?
Yeah, pretty much without exception, in everywhere except Ghazni, because of the insecurity issues, people talked about definitely voting, definitely going to participate. This was something I had to do to take part in the government. It was a good thing. It was an opportunity. People talked about last year in the provincial council elections, presidential elections, running to the polling station, quickly voting and running back again because they were scared about suicide bombers, etc., but making the effort anyway. So from what we collected in terms of our data, there was a lot of positive attitudes towards voting and a lot of people committing to voting. However, I wouldn't necessarily say that this would translate automatically into people actually voting, and that when being interviewed in a situation like that from people who maybe they don't know so well, they might want to give a good impression and say, yes, it's my duty to vote, and actually not on polling day. And I think it also depends who you talk to as well, whether they were urban residents, whether they're in the villages. I think that makes a difference in terms of whether people vote or not. Not for the obvious sort of urban residents live nearer to the polling station, so it's easier, so they would vote more. But because of the way in which in Kabul, for example, service provision can be accessed through wasita and through relatives in the central government, which you have pretty close at hand, whereas in the villages you wouldn't necessarily have that, and that means that the emphasis placed on getting it a representative at the central level is much stronger, so the stakes are higher, so maybe they're more likely to vote there. So from what we could see, there was a generally positive attitude towards voting, but I wouldn't want to say that would translate necessarily into actual votes.
A follow-up question asks how respondents felt about fraud.
Very, very many people criticised the fraud in elections. Also, what's worth noting is that the data collected for the first round of interviews was collected before the presidential elections, and the data for the second round was collected between the presidential and the parliamentary ones. So there is a difference there in terms of people's perspectives on the fraud, because of course the debacle of 2009 was quite a shake-up, I suppose, in many ways. So people complained about fraud, but they also complained about it in 2004-2005. They said, you know, then they had also seen ballot boxes being stuffed and thrown into the river and this kind of thing. So it wasn't a new phenomenon necessarily. And what was absolutely clear from the data was, as well as this idea of fraud, this worry about the results being changed after the election. So the worry that they would be manipulated at the central level, or UNAMA would change them, or, you know, quite a lot of suspicions of international or external intervention for political gain. So people did talk about that an awful lot. However, they still said, in spite of that, that they were going to vote anyway, and that it was important to vote. And I'm generalising, but that really was quite clear across all of the data. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.